Hello, everyone. I'm Cressida Cowell, author of How to Train Your Dragon, and I'm just popping in to tell you about my new book series, Which Way to Anywhere. It's a story about four children who discover that there are alternative worlds beyond our own, and that they can travel to them with the help of a magical map and a very special gift. Of course, this leads to epic, unexpected adventures. Which Way to Anywhere and its sequel, Which Way Round the Galaxy, are both available to buy now. Happy reading!
This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB Digital Radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Right, it's time to learn the secrets that stitch together the very fabric of our universe. Hello, welcome along. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan, thanks for so much for giving us a listen. This is the show that takes the sneakiest peek inside the most epically incredible things that exist. Now this week we learn about the largest snake in the world. Also, we'll talk about new plans to put humans on the moon, and I've got a couple of your questions to answer in just a sec. Shoutouts to do as well after we give our alien best mates NNG a lift back home.
NNG's meter motivator.
Hey NNG.
What's up, kid? Got a question about energy?
Sure have. I want to be a smart meter motivator so I can help Gran and her friends. They're thinking of getting them installed. Thing is, I still don't exactly know how you get one or what happens when you do.
Oh, smart grand human. She must be revered as one of your most high-thinking clever bots.
Just a earthling that hates waste. But she's wondering how long it takes to get it set up. After all, she's a busy lady. She goes to Zumba 5 times a week.
Zumba. Isn't that in the Andromeda Nebula? Gosh, yes. She'll need all the energy she can get.
Fear not. It's simple. Listen up. Your gran can contact the power company to make an appointment for the fitting at a time that's convenient for her. It's up to her when they come around and even if she wants to have a meter installed.
And don't forget, it's at no extra cost.
On the agreed day, an engineer will arrive.
They'll do some important checks to make sure that the gas and electric power supplies are safely installed before switching them off whilst they do the work.
They'll look at where the meters are and aim to replace them in the same place. There'll be one for electricity and one for gas.
Each one will take about one of your Earth hours to fit. But remember, you won't be able to use the power supply during this time, so it's important to plan ahead, especially in cold weather. Gran will need to stay warm.
She'll probably make a flask of tea to tide her over. She does that normally so she doesn't have to keep boiling the kettle.
Oh, that's a cosmic way of saving energy.
They would need to dig up the garden.
Or the road.
Or reroute traffic around the Dogstar Pulsar system.
And when everything's installed, your granny Clever Clogs can get a portable energy display that she can keep anywhere in her home. It'll show her everything working as it should be.
Gran's really good with gadgets, but will the engineers help her to figure out how it works?
Of course! She'll be shown how the energy display works so that she can see how much gas and electricity is being used.
And she'll be given lots of tips about how it can help her start some serious energy watching. It can be helpful to have a friend along, someone who can ask questions too.
And remember, once she has her smart meter, she won't ever need to take meter readings again, so the meters themselves can stay in their cupboards.
And it won't change the amount she pays.
The only thing that changes is the meter. Her tariff will stay the same. It'll just be easier to see how much energy she's using.
She'll love that.
And we love energy-saving earthlings. Good work, meter motivator. Watch out! Looks like we're gonna fuse, G! Time for us to pop!
Here it comes! Woohee! I love a bit of fusion! See you, kid!
Bye, NNG, and thanks!
Here it comes!
Find out how you can be a meter motivator with NNG. With support from Smart Energy GB. Find out more at funkidslive.com/NNG.
Energy.
Right, let's head over to Apple Podcasts then and have a look at some of your reviews and answer some of your questions. Remember, if you've got something sciencey in your brain that you need worked through and explained to you, that's what you need to do. Find the Fun Kids Science Weekly over on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. Hey to Bailey in Cleveland, Ohio, over in America, who has done just that. Hey, Bailey. Bailey asks, how do maglev trains work? Now, maglev trains can run insanely fast. They're known for always breaking world speed records. And the science behind it is really quite simple, but it's quite tough to explain, so you might need to bear with me. Their name really, though, perfectly explains what they are. Maglev stands for magnetic levitation, and the trains take advantage of one of the fundamentals of science, that magnets can both attract and repel. Now, the trains hover above the tracks because there are magnets under the train and on top of the track, the rails, which are both from the same magnetic pole. So they repel each other, which means that the train levitates just above it. They can never touch. And that means it can travel extra fast because there's no friction. Now, to move, there are also magnets on the side of the train and the side of the tracks. And these are switched rapidly between north and south poles, so that the train is always being moved further up the track as it's attracted to magnets, which are higher along the line. Do you kind of get that? And the faster that you switch the magnetic poles, the quicker the train moves. Thank you so much for that, Bailey. Let's move on to the other side of the world from America, Australia, and say hi to Aaron in Canberra, who has honestly asked one of the most beautifully simple questions that we've ever had on the show. Why don't spiders stick to their webs? Amazing. Aaron, you know, I love that. Not worried about the big issues, what's really wrong with the world, the huge science problems, just something that's so wondrous that no one ever asks. And it's a simple answer, actually, Aaron. The reason that spiders don't stick to the webs is because they really hardly touch it at one time. Spiders nimbly move, making as little contact as they can to the web. In fact, only the hairs at the very tips of their legs touch the silky thread, which means they can't really get stuck. Amazing question. I hope the answer did it justice. Thank you so much, Aaron. If you've got a science question that you need answered on the show, you need to leave it as a review for the Fun Kids Science Weekly over on Apple Podcasts. Now, if you live in the UK, maybe somewhere near London, something very exciting is happening. You see, on April the 22nd, which is the bank holiday Monday just after Easter, we're doing our live stage show, the Fun Kids Epic Roadshow Adventure. Now, Bex from the club in the afternoons during the week on Fun Kids and I, we are starring in it with you. You're another star of the show. You see, it's a live, interactive stage show where everything goes wrong. And the big, awful, horrendous Fun Kids boss has said that if it keeps going wrong, if it's awful, then we might get fired. He's going to stick on his steel-toed shoes and boot us out of the building, so it's down to you to come along and save the day. You can help us make a radio show. We'll do the news, you can help us tell stories, we'll play games, and at the end, we form a band and we make music to save the whole thing. Now, we did this show live for a month at the Edinburgh Festival last year. It went down an absolute storm, and this is a one-time-only thing. We don't know if we'll do it ever again, so make sure you're there in London. Help us out, make sure we're not fired. It's all happening on April the 22nd at the Underbelly South Bank Festival, just around the corner from the London Eye and Waterloo Station, so it's dead easy to get to. And you can find out more. You can meet us afterwards as well. Come and say hello. We'll get selfies, high fives, all of that. For tickets to the Fun Kids Epic Roadshow Adventure, get online to funkidslive.com. Now, our special guest this week on the Fun Kids Science Weekly is a champion of bees, snakes, and all the little things in life. Clay Bolt is a natural history and conservation photographer. Clay, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've been all over the place searching for little creatures to photograph. I want you to tell us about the creature that you're most proud of capturing in action.
Well, I have to say, I've photographed a lot of different things over the years that have really made me excited. But just recently, I came back from a trip to Indonesia where I was able to go on a trip with some of my friends to rediscover the world's largest bee, Wallace's giant bee, which is this amazing bee that's about the size of your thumb. And that was a trip that I planned for many years. So to have the opportunity to go and find it in the forest of Indonesia and photograph it was a pretty remarkable moment.
So when you went over to Indonesia, and you say, you know, you've planned this for many, many years, how did you know? How were you so sure that you were going to find it? How did you know where to look? What were you searching out for? What signs were you trying to spot that it might be nearby?
Well, this is a very mysterious creature. It was first discovered by an English explorer named Alfred Russel Wallace in 1858. And it wasn't seen again until 1981 by a forester and entomologist named Adam Messer. Messer wrote a paper in 1984 giving some of the details about where he had found the bee. And so we used his descriptions of where the bee might be found. And then we took those descriptions of the type of habitat and we looked at satellite imagery on Google and did some research. The area that it's found in is a region of the world that's rarely traveled to by outsiders called the North Malacca. It's a very small group of islands that have tropical lowland forest. So we looked for pieces and patches of this lowland forest where we thought the bee could still exist. And basically, once we got there, we just targeted some places where the forest still existed and began to look for it within those habitat patches.
And how long were you looking for before you spotted one?
Well, the trip basically essentially took us probably 8 years total to get there. And once we got there, we actually found it within about 6 days. So it was a lot of planning on the front end. And then once we got there, it was 6 days of going through the forest, looking at these termite mounds in which it lived. We'd spend 20 to 30 minutes looking at these different mounds day after day. So yeah, about 6 days in the forest after we finally arrived on the island.
Years and years and years ago, I'm labelling you as quite old there, Clay, but what I mean is right at the start of your career taking photographs, what made you get into it? Why the fascination with the smaller creatures around?
Well, ever since I was a kid, I've been fascinated with insects, and I don't really know where this love came from. I was just a kid in school who would try to rescue toads, rescue praying mantises, from, you know, places like outside of restaurants and take them to my home and release them in the wild. I was just always fascinated with these little things. And I was also a kid who was really good at drawing. So I combined my passion for art and for nature into this career that I have. And I've always just really had a passion for speaking up for those little things and helping people see them in a different way. So I'm kind of living the dream as far as making something that I've always been passionate about into my career.
Now, you said, you know, fighting for the little creatures. Tell us more about the rusty-patched bumblebee, because you were quite instrumental in the fight to protect that creature.
Yeah, so, you know, everyone hears a lot these days about bad things that are happening to bees. And here in the U.S., there was a lot of concern about the loss of honeybees. But what many people, especially here in the U.S., don't realize is that honeybees are actually not a native species to the U.S. They're actually native to Europe and Asia and places like that. So what I wanted to do was change the story a little bit and talk about some of our native bees. We have, in the U.S. and Canada, nearly 4,000 species of native bees, and those are a lot of stories to be told. And when I began to photograph those species and talk about the stories, someone told me the story of the rusty patch bumblebee, which was a very important native bumblebee that was in serious trouble. It had declined almost 90% in 15 years, so it was almost gone, and no one really knew about it. So I decided to make a film called A Ghost in the Making about this bee and try to help people realize that if we don't do something right now, it could go extinct. So I used the film and my photographs to talk to people around the country, raise signatures, and we actually used that information and those signatures to place the rusty patch bumblebee on the endangered species list.
Now, on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, we love our dangerous creatures. Now, bees are pretty dangerous, and I don't really know how deadly some of the other animals that you interact with are. But can you tell us about a moment where you have come across something that is pretty devastatingly dangerous, but you've got to be there to take the photo?
Well, I have photographed quite a lot of snakes, and while I typically find that most animals are actually quite safe as long as you're respectful of them, I was in a place called Little St. Simon's Island, which is a barrier island found on the border between Georgia and Florida, and I was looking for diamondback rattlesnakes. Now, the eastern diamondback rattlesnake is a very large venomous snake that is found primarily in the southeastern United States. And I was in this place that was loaded with these snakes, and I really wanted to get a photograph of it. So I remember I was walking through this thicket, and all of a sudden, my guide said, stop. And we looked down, and there was, right on the ground, very close to me, was this large diamondback rattlesnake coiled up. And I didn't see it at all, and it was so close. But you know, the funny thing is, even though this is a very venomous snake, it showed no aggression towards me because I gave it respect. And so I think I've been very fortunate that I'm either with someone who understands the behavior or I've done the research myself. And as long as I give respect to these animals, they typically are not very aggressive towards me. But that was definitely a scary moment where I could have stepped on the snake, and that might not have been too good for me.
Now, we've already heard, Clay, just how dedicated you are to getting the perfect picture to an animal. I mean, traveling across to Asia to find a bee, for instance. What's left for you to try and take photos of? What creatures do you have on the hit list?
Oh, there's so many. There's too many to name. You know, I think one of the things that I'm actually most passionate about is not so much going far away to these remote places, but really learning more about the species that live around me in my own backyard, for example. So I recently heard about a type of bee that pollinates pitcher plants, these carnivorous plants that live pretty close to where I live in Oregon. So that's probably going to be the next thing that I try to document. And there's also a bee that pollinates flowers at night, so it actually flies around in the dark. And for me, that'd be fascinating to imagine getting a photo of that bee flying in front of the moon on an evening primrose or something like that. I think that'd be a really unique photo to share with people.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And if you're listening and you love your creatures, and because you're listening, I hope you do search out Clay Bolt online, because some of the pictures on his website are absolutely stunning. Clay, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
On the Fun Kids website this week, there's a brand new series all about the Internet of Things. Technomum is going to be telling us all about how your iPad talks to your car, or your house, or your body. Plus, there's a chance to win a nature kit, an Amazon smart speaker, and loads more. Just visit funkidslive.com on your computer, phone, or tablet.
It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, and it's the turn of the largest snake in the world. The green anaconda can grow up to 9 metres in length. It weighs up to 250 kilograms, a quarter of a tongue. And get this, the females are even larger than the males. They're bigger than that. They're found in the swampy marshes of South America. Now, you'll notice them, if you are nearby, by their olive green skin. They're covered in black blotches too. Now, they spend much of their time in the water, and they're perfectly adept at speedily racing their huge body towards any prey that might be nearby. And it's sneaky. You see, the eyes and the nose are located right at the top of the head, so they can see and they can breathe while the rest of their huge body is pretty much submerged completely underwater. Now, the green anaconda is an ambusher, a predator. It'll wait until its prey comes near them, biding its time until the very last moment when it zooms out of the water, striking with incredible speed. And the large body is pretty brilliant at one very specific way of killing. They'll quite literally squeeze the life out of the prey, eating deer, tapir, crocodiles, turtles. They'll get tighter and tighter and tighter until all that's left for the green anaconda to do, the largest snake in the world, is to swallow the snack whole. And at something that's 9 meters in length, come on, I think you'll agree it needs to go on our Dangerous Dan list. Shall we get some of your geeky questions answered? Good, let's do it. Here's our gadget guru, Techno Mum.
Techno Mum, Engineering Explorers. This app is so addictive. It was free too. Pretty simple really, just matching frogs. I wonder how they made the game. Can't have been that difficult.
Shouldn't you be tidying your room?
Just finishing this level. So Mum, here's a question for you. A games programmer's also engineers.
Of course, they're software engineers. Software is the name for the computer programs which contain the instructions to run apps, games, applications, even machinery.
I suppose there are computers in pretty much everything these days.
That's right. Not just inside a PC. There will be computer programs inside kitchen appliances, like washing machines, inside the cars we drive, not to mention electronic toys and smartwatches. And they're used in helping manufacture all these things too, whether a car on a production line or a plastic drinking bottle.
But how do software engineers make a program? It's not like building a house where you've got bricks and cement to work with.
Software has its own building blocks, computer code. Just like there are hundreds of different languages spoken around the world, there are hundreds of different computer languages which create different types of code. Software engineers learn these languages and use them to create computer code.
It's hard enough learning one language. Do you have to learn all the languages?
I'm sure there's some very smart computer programmers who do know a large number of computer languages, but often software engineers will specialise in just one. It might depend on the type of programs they're writing. If you want to write programs for the internet, or for apps like the one you're playing, then you'll need to learn Java, JavaScript, and perhaps PHP. These are the languages behind the video games you play on your console too. If the programs you write are going to carry out complicated calculations, and if you want to be able to sort out and analyze data, then SQL is the language you need. A very popular language is called C. It's used in lots of ways, often in the background where it can talk to hardware. It might be giving the instructions to a hydraulic robot on a car production line, or running the program that makes your telly or radio work. As there are loads of applications and languages, software engineers will study a range before choosing an area in which to specialise.
I definitely choose video game programming.
No surprises there. It's a very exciting time to be a software engineer. They're working with cool new technology to shape our homes and lives in many new ways.
Alexa, set an alarm for 7 a.m.
Computer code is used to connect apps and smart gadgets. A control app can connect with a clock app to set an alarm, or connect to a music app to play your favourite tune. It can even connect to smart light bulbs and switches in your house to turn appliances on and off when you're not there.
Cool! I wonder if it could tidy up my bedroom or finish my homework for me.
Well, in the future it might be possible, but it'd be a lot quicker if you just get on with it and do it yourself.
Engineering Explorers, created with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology to celebrate the Year of Engineering. Find out more at funkidslive.com/technomum.
Right, it's time to talk about all the science that has been in your news this week. The US is aiming to put astronauts back on the moon in the next 5 years. Vice President Mike Pence has announced that the country is back in a space race. NASA is now aiming to target the lunar South Pole, a region with areas in almost permanent darkness. Also, British scientists are about to undertake one of the biggest dinosaur hunts in decades. They're joining the Dutch and the US institutions in exploring the badlands of Wyoming over in the States. It's expected to be a treasure trove of fossils. In the past, it's yielded some of the most famous specimens that we've got. They will excavate 1 square mile of ground, hoping for whole dinosaurs to be lifted from there. And finally, a third of British wild bees and hoverflies are in decline, according to a new study. And this is terrible news. If current trends continue, some of the species will be lost from Britain altogether. Now, we've already heard that bees play a huge part in global wildlife. We've talked about it on this show quite a lot. So this is obviously bad, and scientists warn that the loss of nature could create world problems in the years to come. And that is it for this week on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. If you've got a sciencey question that you really need answered, and if you want to shout out on the show, it's dead simple. All you need to do, head over to the Apple Podcast place, Apple Podcasts, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, drop us a review, leave us 5 stars in the box at the bottom. That's where you need to leave your question. I'll see it, and I'll say hello. And while you're over on Apple Podcasts, it's a brilliant place that you can find all our Fun Kids series, some of them you've heard today. You can also get them on Spotify and on all other brilliant podcast places. Now you can listen to Fun Kids as well. We're a kids radio station across the UK. Get us on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app. And as always, at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello everyone, I'm Cressida Cowell, author of How to Train Your Dragon, and I'm just popping in to tell you about my new book series, Which Way to Anywhere. It's a story about four children who discover that there are alternative worlds beyond our own and that they can travel to them with the help of a magical map and a very special gift. Of course, this leads to epic, unexpected adventures. Which Way to Anywhere and its sequel, Which Way Round the Galaxy, are both available to buy now. Happy reading!